Welcome to the Good Mood Show. This is the show where you will learn the best strategies to feel the good moods and good vibes we all love to feel. Now, here's your host, Matt O'Neill.
Welcome to the Good Mood Show. I'm your host, Matt O'Neill. Be sure to hit subscribe so that you get a good mood every single week. Today, we are talking with Ryan Bush, who is focused on building better systems, better people, and a better future. Ryan, I'm so excited to share your wisdom and your theories and happiness with the audience of the Good Mood Show. Welcome to the Good Mood Show.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks, Matt.
So, Ryan, I just loved your definition of happiness. You know, I study happiness and it just kind of blew me away. I love the three dimensions that you talk about with pain and pleasure, gain and loss, and then the third dimension of virtue or admiration. How did you come up with this?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was a lot of things kind of coming together. I mean, for one thing, I've been studying a lot of these phenomena for a decade and a half, kind of scratching my head at it and, researching everything I could get my hands on, trying to figure out why something seems so counterintuitive, so backwards about our sort of popular notions of happiness. And then I wrote my first book, and in the process of writing that, I actually had a kind of a mental health struggle of my own that caused everything for this book to kind of click into place for me. It wasn't super fun at the time, but looking back after that year, essentially, I'm really grateful that it all happened because it sort of led to this theory coming together. Essentially, I was at a job that was sort of increasingly failing to bring out my personal strengths. It was really, getting to a point where I was feeling like I didn't have an outlet for bringing out the things that were best, that I was best at. I had, everything from, like, I was doing really tedious engineering drawings at the time. That's not my strength. I had a coworker who kind of was antagonizing me for a little while. I was grappling with a kind of a neurodivergent diagnosis of my own. And it all kind of led to a decline in my self-esteem, kind of for the first time in my life, and what I would describe as a mild depression. And, after as I was coming out of this experience and saying, okay, what happened there? What am I not accounting for? I think a lot of these things just kind of clicked together, and this model kind of emerged out of it. And so, something good came out of all that.
Well, I'm so glad you are sharing that backstory, because all of us have grappled with feeling lower self-esteem. All of us have felt weeks on end, I'm sure, where we don't feel like our best self and we're not living in our strengths. But that was the part about your book that was so exciting for me, because that's really the formula that you have redefined what it means to, you call this book the opposite of depression rather than a pursuit of happiness. And I kind of want to break down the theory for the person that's listening. Would you mind just talking about the three planes of happiness?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, happiness has a lot of different definitions and understandings. There's pleasure, there's joy, there's a lot of different things. So I kind of talk about the opposite of depression to refer to a very specific kind of happiness that's kind of the deepest sense. And that's what I think we're all ultimately after. But I've sort of argued that we're all going around navigating our lives with a faulty map. We're pursuing happiness without accounting for the factors that actually produce happiness much of the time. And that's why we feel like it comes and goes, and we stumble across happiness instead of sort of managing it more in a more coordinated way. And so this model that I developed, if you imagine there's a chessboard sitting in front of you on the table, and there's an x-axis, which is the left and right, and this represents pain and pleasure. So you go to the right, there's more pleasure. You go to the left, there's more pain. The y-axis, which is kind of moving closer to you or further away from you, this represents loss and gain. So you've got, further away from you, that's moving up in the y-axis. That is more gain, more success, more sort of external accomplishments, and downward is loss.
You use the example in your book of drinking alcohol. So possibly on the x-axis across the horizontal plane, that could be a really pleasurable experience. But if we drink too much and we get hammered and then we're hungover and we had a big important meeting the next day, that could be a loss for us. So on this 2D map, we could kind of map out each of the activities that we choose on a pain, pleasure, or gain and loss sequence, but it doesn't, it's incomplete as you describe.
Exactly. Yeah. Once we become, you know, responsible adults, we learn how to delay gratification and put, you know, the long-term gain part over the short-term pleasure. So yeah, we can forego the night of, you know, drunken partying for our research paper or whatever. But yeah, there's still something very much missing, in that if you just navigate using this two-dimensional plane, you're going to be confused a lot in your life about what is actually producing the happiness or unhappiness that you're feeling at any given time. And so what I introduce is you can imagine sort of extruding mountains and valleys in this chessboard. So now it's kind of a topographical map. We've introduced a third dimension. And so while you're going around chasing either short-term pleasure or these kind of external gains in your life, you may be moving up and down in this third dimension without realizing it and without really understanding why your well-being seems like it's fluctuating. And so this third dimension, I sort of introduce initially as admirability, because this is a very sort of intuitive word. We know what it means to admire someone and to admire ourselves. And so essentially what's happening, I argue, is that our brains are constantly monitoring us for admirability, for traits and behaviors that we admire ourselves. And when we find a lot of evidence of that on a daily basis, even if we are, you know, struggling and experiencing pain or loss or something, we still have a deeper sense of happiness that pervades. Whereas if we find ourselves in a place where we are not seeing evidence of those strengths that we admire in ourselves, then we kind of move into the valleys of happiness and get, you know, potentially dangerously close to depression, even if things seem good in our lives on paper. And so it's about learning to pay attention to this hidden dimension that we weren't really built. Our brains didn't really evolve to pay attention to this dimension, but it's what's really pulling the strings of our satisfaction in life.
Do you know how many people have asked to be on this podcast to talk about how they were in a big corporate job, making a ton of money? On paper, it looked like they had everything. They had a marriage that looked really great. They had children. They had a bunch of money. They were driving the nice cars. They had the nice house. And they say, and I was miserable.
Right.
But they had all the money to have all the pleasurable experiences, probably went on amazing vacations, right? Had living in the right house, at the right address, probably everything that they ever thought they wanted. And they had lots of, so you got the gain and the pleasure. They had both on the chessboard. But your theory would say that that person probably wasn't doing the height dimension, which is doing things that they felt were admirable.
Yes, yes. We've all heard that story a million times. And on some level, we all recognize it. We're all like, yeah, you know, that makes sense that you weren't happy even though you had all that. And yet when it comes to directing our lives, so often we do act like that is the end all be all, when really it's not how it works. You know, there's plenty of data on this too. Lottery winners, you know, a year after they have won the lottery, they're back down to the same level of happiness. It didn't do anything. And similarly, an equivalent loss, like, you know, becoming paraplegic, losing your legs, literally, the same thing. We expect that to be the worst possible thing for our happiness. And then when it actually happens, after a short period of time, we're back to the same level of happiness. But notably, it's not that our happiness doesn't ever change. It's not like we just have this set point, because I've experienced just in the last few years a pretty wide range in terms of my overall well-being, like on a scale from 1 to 10. So it can change, but it doesn't change based on that kind of thing is the core message that I tried to sort of drill into in this book.
Yeah. And you talk about it, you say, so now knowing this, knowing that we need to behave in ways that we think are admirable or in ways that we admire other people behaving, it's now our job to create unique personal virtues and then maximize the total amount of virtue in our own character. So how do we identify these unique personal virtues within ourselves to know what behaviors we should be doing?
Yeah. So ultimately, my understanding of it is that it's sort of about just maximizing the total amount of virtue that you're able to bring out in your life and show yourself evidence for. But we know from a lot of things that it can often be more useful to focus on sort of doubling down on your strengths rather than focusing all on your weaknesses. And so identifying the things that you already have an innate proclivity for, right? Your natural strengths is one of the best ways to maximize this virtue dimension. And so there are a few ways of doing this. One is that there's a, you know, if you want something relatively quick, there's a Strengths Finder survey. The VIA Institute has a great one developed by Martin Seligman for sort of identifying like your top five greatest strengths. That's sort of one angle for doing it. Another is to just go to people who have known you for a long time and just ask them, what have I always been really good at? And very often they will surprise you with their answers, actually. You know, you can also ask yourself more about what it is that you value in others. So you can look at some of the people that you have the most admiration for, some, you know, whether it's people in your life or, you know, ancient philosophers or fictional characters, identify those people and figure out which traits it is that you admire about them, which behaviors they take that cause you to say, man, I really want to have that trait. I want to be like that. And write all this stuff down so that you can kind of map out these virtues. And then you can use this as a way of determining your sort of next move in your life as you're trying to develop greater, deeper well-being. Instead of just looking at whether this new job has a higher salary, you got to look at, will this enable me to bring out more of these strengths, to exercise more of my personal virtues than I am currently? And this is not just a work thing. This is work, it's relationships, it's communities. We have lots of different strengths. I know virtue has this kind of outdated sounding tone to it. We think of it as like a moral purity kind of thing. But ultimately, I use the term to refer to everything from courage to creativity to compassion, you know, your sense of humor. It's all something that you admire in a person and will admire in yourself when you see evidence of those traits. And so that's the crucial thing, I think, to pay attention to as you're directing and navigating your life.
I love making things really practical. And so you gave us three practical exercises that we can do to find our virtues, to find what will make us feel self-admiration. And I'm just going to repeat those for the person listening. I have taken StrengthsFinder survey. It's awesome. It's quick. You could just Google StrengthsFinder and take their survey. I think it's free. You might just have to put your email address in and it'll come back and say, hey, based on the way you answered the survey, these are your five strengths. This is where you should be spending your time. And then focus your life around spending your time in those strengths. And that's going to bring you a lot of fulfillment. The other thing that I've heard, and I haven't done this myself, is asking the people who know you best, hey, what am I really good at? And I think I'm going to have to do that survey so that I can spend more time on my strengths. Because sometimes we got a blind spot to ourselves. I can see what somebody else is really gifted at or where somebody else might have some weaknesses, but maybe I'm not able as much to see it in myself. And the last thing you had said is think about the people you admire most. Write a list about what it is you admire about them. And then those are probably things you admire in your own self. And this can create a map of your virtues. You had said it like, it could just be making people laugh. Like It could be just when you're hanging out with people that you make them feel good, and that that could be one of your strengths. Like, it doesn't have to be that you're some great speaker or some great writer. It can just be everyday stuff too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to use this framework to kind of craft your relationships too. Like, who am I around that allows me to bring out the best in myself? Who do I feel the best about myself, the most proud of who I am when I'm around? Because there are some people who will, you know, kind of deprive you of the opportunity to bring out those strengths, either because they just don't have that appreciation for them. They don't reward them. They don't, sometimes people can be punishing in their, you know, jealousy in some ways. Mm. So you have to navigate these things by asking, you know, what are those things that I'm really good at that I feel proud of myself when I do, and who enables me to bring those traits out.
And don't we love hanging around people that have a high opinion of us? People who are like big supporters of ours, that recognize what our strengths are and encourage us on in that way.
Yeah. There are people that I've been around that I really like them, but I don't really like me around them. And so I kind of limit my time around them, because that's a huge part of what friendship and relationships are about.
Hey, if you love to stay in good moods as much as I do, be sure to hit the subscribe button on the Good Mood Show podcast. That way we can get you a good mood every single week. And look, if you know someone else that could use a good mood, share the show with them. Send them a text message. Let them know about the Good Mood Show, and let's brighten up the world. A long time ago, early in my career as a company owner, I own a real estate company. I read Jim Collins' books, Good to Great and Built to Last. And he said the DNA of these companies that last 100 years of success is they identify five core values and then they live by them. And it's not just words on a wall. It's like the DNA of who they are. And they attract people to them that match the values, and they repel people from them that don't match the values. And I created these five core values for my company. And then with my wife, we created core values for our family. And they're pretty aligned. But in a way, I was kind of creating my own values about what I really cared about. And
absolutely.
And so by living by those company core values, the first value I selected was integrity, which to me means being honest in our dealings, doing what we say we're going to do, doing things the right way, even if no one's looking. That setting that first, that's one of the things I admire most, right? When somebody else acts that way. And so when I act with integrity, even if no one's looking, I feel really good about myself. And the second core value we created was kindness. And at home, we've got a picture of a heart and it says, O'Neills are kind. And that's really, to me, like the number one value of my whole life is if someone is acting with kindness, even when it's hard to do so. It's like, so when I'm acting with kindness, even in a situation that would be hard to do so, I feel really proud of myself.
Yeah, that's a fantastic exercise for a business or a family or yourself. Like, I encourage everyone to do that kind of thing. And those are great first values. And you know, integrity is really interesting in regards to this theory, because you can view it as a virtue itself. You can, you know, and it's one of my top virtues as well. But you can also look at this mechanism as a kind of like, real justification for integrity. Because even if no one else is watching, even if, you do something good and no one else is around, or you do something that you think you can get away with, taking somebody's wallet, for example, like if you find it on the ground and choose to keep it instead of returning it, there's no real life consequences for that. But if this theory is correct, then there really is a mechanism in your brain that is going to lower your own mood based on your lack of self-approval. If you wouldn't admire someone else doing what you did, it doesn't matter if anyone saw, your brain saw, you saw, and that's the most important person who can disapprove of you, and it'll have the worst effects to disapprove of yourself.
That's always been my understanding of karma. It may not necessarily be that, God or the universe is counting and they see that you took that wallet. and that one day your wallet will be taken from you down the road. More, I've always understood karma as I took the guy's wallet. I knew I shouldn't have, but I thought I could get away with it. But subconsciously, I'm not proud of myself. And my own devalued worth now has made the price that it cost me to get the wallet not worth it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so much worse. I mean, there's no worse prison than being in the prison of being a person you yourself don't approve of. And this is where, you know, it kind of ties into depression, because people who are depressed pretty much invariably don't approve of themselves. They have very low self-esteem. They, you know, if they're severely depressed, they often say things like, I'm incompetent, unlovable, worthless. And we pretty much see the opposite in people who are deeply satisfied in their lives and not depressed at all. And so this is what I argue is there's basically a scale running from depression to what the ancient Greeks called eudaimonia, which is a very deep kind of self-approving, virtuous well-being. And you move up and down on this scale based on your own behaviors every day. And so there really is this mechanism, I call it the self-appraisal system, that monitors us for approvable traits. And it triggers moods that will bring about behaviors that are socially adaptive, just based on our evolution. You know, if we are not highly approvable, and that's what our brains sort of determine about us, right? Our brains are going to want us to withdraw and be socially risk averse and not put ourselves out there, because that could do damage to our social status. And so that is why I argue depression exists in the first place, is that it evolved as an adaptation to sort of limit our social exposure when we aren't demonstrating traits that we approve of ourselves for and hence aren't likely to be approved by others for.
I love this whole talk about evolution. I loved your whole section on the peacock's tail. As you're like, this is the most ridiculous. I think it was, you said Darwin would look at a peacock and just get so angry at their tail. Like, this tail makes no sense. That bird should not be alive with that big elaborate tail. It's like a target on their back. Every predator can see that bird with its big peacocking tail and should kill it and eat it. And I don't understand it. And you had a totally different view about the peacock's tail and how us as humans have also created our own kind of peacocking. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. So Darwin, you know, early in the days of his evolutionary theory, he had only figured out sort of the environmental selection component that says, like, you should, you know, your genes will get passed on if you do things that help you survive. Well, there was a big problem with that, and that there were all these animals that were seen to be doing things that didn't seem to help survival. In fact, they almost seemed to hurt survival, and things that wouldn't help it at all. And the peacock's tail is a great example of that. It's a big target on its back saying, come and eat me, predators. And it also, you know, just growing a tail like that costs more energy, and so you need more food to sustain it. So why would that have been preserved? Why would peacocks that had, you know, little discrete tails not have been selected for? And the answer is basically that it was selected specifically because it took a very fit peacock to be able to survive in spite of having that big target on its back. And so it became attractive for that very reason, because it's a fitness indicator. Well, Jeffrey Miller argues in his book, The Mating Mind, that the human mind is in many ways, a collection of fitness indicators, just like the peacock's tail, just like exotic birds and their songs and their crazy dances and stuff. We have these mental traits that we bring out, this kind of cognitive plumage full of language and creativity and generosity, and these traits that you wouldn't think would serve our survival all that much. I mean, some of them you can kind of make sense of, but it's like, why would we be so interested in, you know, creating art or writing books or something? There's no way that helps survival. Well, it helps social and mate selection, because it's, you know, people who have these traits are capable of surviving even though they are doing these things that aren't directly serving their survival. And that takes a fit individual. And so all these virtues, I argue, came about through this social selection process. You know, the reason why we have generosity for the most part, is because it took a really fit individual to be able to give something up for someone else in their tribe, right? And that is, that serves as a really powerful indicator to potential mates. Oh, this is a fit person. This is someone who is capable of surviving and being generous and being creative.
And it's a signal to myself, you know? So if I, if I'm able to be generous and offer money or time or whatever equity I have to someone else, it signals to myself that I have more than enough and that I'm really fit, that I'm really strong. And then that fortifies my mindset to go out and be fit and strong and be successful too.
Exactly. And the self-signaling component is a big part of this, because if it's true that we evolved to want to signal these traits to other people, right, then it would make the most sense that we would also signal them to ourselves, because we need a way of monitoring and evaluating ourselves as well, right? It would be, you know, equivalent to blindness if this was a huge selective force that we weren't tracking ourselves. And this is why we have an internal monologue. This is why we have self-criticisms in the negative sense, and also a lot of just general self-referential thoughts, even positive thoughts, because our brain, a part of it, is constantly monitoring for these things, sending signals to ourselves so that we know how we're doing socially. And that is where this whole mood mechanism came from, ultimately.
Well, I want to spend more time in eudaimonia, or however you pronounce that word. I want to spend more time feeling admirable and feeling like I'm living in my virtues. And you gave me some good ways to find those virtues. But once I've identified the things that are my strengths, and there could be many of them, what do you think a good list would be? How many of these things do you think we should be thinking about?
There are a lot of different lists of virtues. And I think ultimately there's no finite list, because if these really are of evolutionary origin, evolution doesn't work in pretty clean ways and create simple categories. So I create sort of a virtue spectrum that has sort of a gradient of infinite shades of virtue. Friedrich Nietzsche, who's a big influence in this whole theory, he said, if you have a virtue, it's your virtue and no one else's. So it's as unique as your fingerprint, essentially, your own combination of virtues.
Yeah.
But it can be helpful to identify, you know, a finite list just for strategy.
Or we're just trying to live a virtuous life. I think is that your whole philosophy here, is we want to live a life of high virtue, but also within our strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also think, you know, it's good to, you know, pin down labels and categories to coordinate all that. And that's where Martin Seligman's work, you know, he studied, you know, all different cultures and found basically 24 core virtues that appear throughout all of them. There are a lot of different ways of slicing it up, but I think that list of 24 is about as good as any that we have. So if you do want to go and study Martin Seligman's list of virtues, that's a great sort of great approach to all this.
And I want to feel good more often. You know, and there's days, you know, this year I'm in the real estate industry, and with interest rates rising, it's been a retracting year. Well, I've always felt really good about growing, and, you know, so this year hasn't felt good in that way. I also finished a manuscript on my first book this year, and I spent much time writing, and I spent less time with my family. And I spent less time doing some of the other things that really bring me joy. And so I related to that part of your book. And so this wasn't like my most feel-good year that I've ever had.
It's a balancing act.
How do we get back on track when we have times like this?
Yeah. So I think one of the best things to pay attention to first is kind of where you're at on that well-being scale, because your strategy will vary. So if you are, you know, pretty low on it, if you are feeling pretty depressed, or maybe even have like a moderate degree of, you know, clinical depression, there are some exercises for sort of getting up to at least the middle space where you can move higher. And so one of those is behavioral activation, which is found in cognitive therapy to be, you know, more effective than, you know, any antidepressant drug and longer lasting effects. So the way this works is, you know, if you are struggling to just get out of bed and take a shower on some days, right? What you want to do is create an activity schedule where you just simply get yourself to do these simple tasks every day. And once you've gotten that down, you add another task to it. Maybe, clean your room every day, do the dishes. These are relatively kind of low virtue tasks, but they still demonstrate some virtues. They demonstrate discipline, right? And you add, a little more, you work your way up, you add exercise and reading to your daily activity schedule. You had calling a friend once a week, and gradually you sort of pull yourself out of this vicious cycle of depression, because you when you're not demonstrating these traits through your life, it causes you to feel bad about yourself. That causes you to have more negative thoughts and perceive yourself as being inferior, and that causes you to feel like doing nothing. And so it's this vicious cycle that goes around and around. When you just target that behavioral leverage point and you say, I'm just going to make sure I do these things every day, you gradually give yourself more and more evidence of your strengths and gradually pull yourself toward a more virtuous life. Now, if you're a little higher up, you may not need to use a strategy like that so much. It's not about a daily activity schedule as much as paying attention to what I call your virtue domains and looking at, okay, so your job may be one of your virtue domains, right? The animal shelter that you volunteer at may be one of your virtue domains. Your marriage might be one of them. Whatever they are for you, the areas that enable you to bring out the most of your strengths, ask yourself how you can craft those to bring out more of those strengths. Ask yourself what you can do in your relationships to bring out these strengths more. Ask yourself if you can make a career change, if you can start a business, if you can write a book, right? Like you were talking about. But it always remains a balancing act. There will always be lots of things competing for your attention and resources. And you're always sort of asking yourself, okay, how can I balance this out the best to achieve the greatest sort of virtue activation? And it's not a simple task. I give as much guidance as I can in this book, but I have failed in it myself. I've prioritized the wrong things and not brought enough of those unique strengths out for my own brain to see.
It's just so fascinating to me. This everything that you've written, your entire theory, I think it has hit the nail on the head when it comes to self-fulfillment and feeling good. I'm just so proud of what you've come up with. I did want to talk about what you wrote about the movement of Eckhart Tolle and teachers like him that say that we should transcend the ego and be completely egoless, and that at our core, if we didn't have an ego, that's where bliss is. That's where happiness is. If we could just get all of these thoughts and desires and attachments and aversions just out of the way, well, then everything would just be happy. And that's what true happiness is. And it's just these silly thoughts that get in the way. How do you feel about that whole movement?
Yeah, so I have pretty mixed feelings about it, because I have personally benefited a lot from things like mindfulness and from teachers like Eckhart Tolle and many other, Eastern teachers. There's so much wisdom in that. And I think ultimately making any change in your mind requires a certain degree of metacognition or mindfulness. And so I think these are very important exercises. Where I tend to disagree is with the very commonly accepted idea today that the goal of mindfulness, the goal of all of our, personal growth journey is to escape our sense of self, is to transcend our ego and get to a point where we have no thought of ourselves. We're just experiencing this moment right now, and we don't have a strong identity. And what I argue is that, many of these teachers, it may be true that they transcended their ego for a time. I assume it is actually possible to do this. To take Eckhart Tolle that I give as an example in the book, he says he, was so depressed at one point in his life, he was just couldn't live with himself anymore. And that thought of not being able to live with himself and asking who is it that I can't live with, or who's not able to live with, it just snapped him into this enlightenment experience where he spent, months without a thought or a care or an identity. And I think it's very possible that happened, and that was much more pleasant than being a person you don't approve of and having all these depressed ruminations and negative thoughts about yourself. But I don't think it's the end goal. I think we can do better than just not having an identity. And I sort of compare it to, if you think about depression as a negative one on this scale, and you think about zero being, you know, this loss of self, the self-transcendence, you know, we want to get to one, which is this state of eudaimonia, which is a strong and positive sense of self, not no sense of self. You know, I kind of bring this home in a few different ways, but the core idea is that this message we're all being told, you know, it's in every self-help book, it's every spirituality book. Your ego is your enemy. Your sense of self is what you have to escape. I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I don't think that we have this, you know, sense of self built into our brains, which seems to be of deep evolutionary origin, for no reason. I think it goes both ways. I think it can cause a lot of suffering, but it can also cause the greatest sense of well-being and happiness available to you. And so while meditation is great for building a better self and kind of stepping back and evaluating our mind as it is now, ultimately, I think the goal should be to go back in and build a better self rather than have no self at all.
Yeah, and I love, because I've said the same thing about Eckhart to my wife. I'm like, man, for somebody that really has no identity, he's got a massive identity.
Yeah.
He's, you know, on Oprah, his books are listed as some of the best-selling books of all time. He's touring all over the world. He's giving all of these seminars. He's working on, his marketing department is working triple overtime. Like they are crushing it. So you say in your book, he's probably really enjoying the self-identity that he has right now. And who wouldn't? He's an international superstar helping people feel better about themselves. Like that would make anyone feel great. And so he doesn't have no identity. He has a pretty fantastic identity.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's a highly admired person. I imagine he probably highly admires himself, and I think he should. So that's where we want to get to ultimately. I don't think it requires becoming an international superstar. I think it's much more about the kind of activities you're doing than the results you're getting. But I think his work has probably served as a really great avenue for bringing out his personal strengths. And that's what ultimately fosters a sense of well-being.
Well, I've got a lot of admiration for him and for you too. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. You know, Ryan is offering that free gift. The book is Self-Mastery. If you want that, just be a subscriber to our newsletter and we'll send it out to you. But Ryan, there's going to be people that just loved this conversation. They're going to want to learn more from you directly. How did they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Depending on when this episode airs, the book may be available for pre-order. It should be going up in a few weeks. So that's Become Who You Are. Should be available at all the major, at least online outlets. But you can also go to designingthemind.org/psychitecture. I can send you that link for the show notes. You can join the email list. I've got some other free books that you can get as well. The Psychitext Toolkit is kind of a overview of, you know, some of my other work. And so, I'd love to have you on the email list and share more with you soon.
I highly recommend it. This Ryan is a genius when it comes to feeling good. And you guys can tell from his theories today. I've just enjoyed it. I've enjoyed your work. I spent all day yesterday just, you know, I was going to get some good points, but then your book was so good. I just read it cover to cover. Like it was just awesome. I just loved it.
That's awesome.
Thank you for being here today. And guys, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Good Mood Show with Matt O'Neill. For free resources, videos, and materials about getting into your best moods, head over to thegoodmoodshow.com. See you next week. Same time, same place.